Welcome to Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute, hosted by Georgina Downer. The name Chris Watson has faded from our memories, but his contribution to the development of the Federal Labor Party and the two-party system in Australia deserves more recognition. Despite opposing federation, Watson was Labor's first federal leader and in 1904 became Australia's third Prime Minister and the first leader of a Labor government in the world. Joining me to discuss Chris Watson is Ross McMullen, author of So Monstrous a Travesty, Chris Watson and the World's First National Labor Government. Welcome to Afternoon Light, Ross.
Thank you, Georgina.
I love that title, by the way. It's the most wonderful quote, very, very striking. Can you tell me, but just as a starting point, can you tell me about this quote?
Yeah, well, a big feature of the book is the hysterical reaction that the advent of the government triggered. And sitting around the publishers one day, we didn't really have a title, and someone there just suggested, well, why don't you pick the most extreme example of the hostility to demonstrate it in the title of the book itself.
Yes.
And that's how we ended up with that one. The Maitland Daily Mercury was in a class of its own, the hysteria that it greeted the government with.
It is the most incredible quote when you read it in its entirety. I mean, they're saying that to call the ministry, I guess the Watson ministry, a government is a flagrant misnomer, as in no respect can so grotesque and absolutely unique a body claim so distinguished a title. And on it goes.
And on it goes.
And obviously, so monstrous a travesty.
And they weren't alone. That was just the most extreme example that we could hone in on to highlight on the front cover as exemplifying this hostility. But there was stacks of other papers saying the same thing, Georgina.
So Chris Watson, the first leader of a Labor government in the world.
Except we should qualify that, except for the 1 week.
Oh, yes, there was a Dawson
Dawson Labor government in then colony of Queensland in 1899.
Right.
So the way I always phrase it is the first national Labor government in the world.
Yes, okay, yes. We don't want to be picked up for fake news. Thank you for the correction. Ross, tell me about Chris Watson. Who was he? He has a very, very interesting past. And, oh, goodness, I was thinking about Section 51 and all those poor sort of citizenship issues, reading his about his place of birth and all his movements. It's very interesting.
It is intriguing, certainly. Chris Watson wasn't always known as Chris Watson. His name initially was Johann Christian Tank, or Tank. T-A-N-C-K. Now, his father, whose name was also Johann Christian Tank, was chief officer of a ship that arrived at Port Chalmers, New Zealand, on Christmas Eve 1865. A few weeks later, he married a local woman, Martha Minchin, and they left New Zealand together on his ship. And in April 1867, when the ship was off the coast of Chile near Valparaiso, the future Prime Minister was born. By the end of 1868, so not long after, Martha had become a single mother.
Right.
Now, it's not clear whether her husband died or they separated, but what is clear is that Martha took young Johann back to New Zealand and she then remarried there after another whirlwind romance. And her second husband was a farmer named George Watson.
Right.
Martha and George proceeded to create a large family of Watsons. And at some stage, it was decided that the stepbrother living with this growing brood would adjust his given names and adopt George's surname. So Johann Christian Tank became John Christian Watson.
I see.
Now, in the circumstances, this was a logical, convenient and hardly surprising change in natural family realities, but it only became sort of retrospectively significant when the newly named John Christian Watson went on to have the illustrious career that he had.
Was it controversial during his political career, or was this something that was uncovered latterly, say, by you or other biographers?
No, it wasn't really controversial during his political career, no, and it seemed to only emerge as a big issue that people made a retrospective fuss about long after his political career. And some have wondered whether he deliberately fudged it, knowingly fudged it.
Yes.
Now, it is possible that Watson did blur his past deliberately, but this is far from clear, and it's also conceivable that he was conveying what George and Martha had told him.
Yes.
And was unaware that his eligibility to sit in Parliament might be open to question.
But as you say, he was born aboard a ship. He wasn't actually born in Valparaiso in Chile, and he was born to a New Zealand mother. So he was at that stage in the 19th century British subject, presumably, given New Zealand was part of the British Empire. So he was treated the same in terms of his nationality as an Australian would have, I'm guessing.
Or as if he'd been born in England, as so many of them
were. Or as if he'd been born in England, indeed. But it's certainly a curious start to life.
It is intriguing,
So, Ross, this is a possibly slightly Chilean, German, New Zealand boy who grows up in New Zealand, but how does he come to Australia? Because this is a story of an Australian Prime Minister, not a New Zealand Prime Minister.
Well, he had limited school. He had various jobs in New Zealand, and at one stage he felt that his prospects would be better in Australia, so he just came over here.
Mm.
His main occupation was as a compositor. And
was that a journalist, a compositor?
No, it's more to the extent that journos are running around finding out things and turning them into stories. A compositor is more like being given a text and then structuring it so that it can be printed in a paper.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
He was a compositor in various papers in Sydney, the Daily Telegraph, Sydney Morning Herald, the Australian Star, and he was also, for a while there, while he was waiting for a job in his chosen trade to emerge, he earned a crust as a stable hand at Government House in Sydney.
Mm.
And the governor saw him there one day and they had a brief chat, and the story goes that the governor gave him a sort of a tip, a sixpence, and expecting that he'd go and buy a beer, Watson bought a book.
Ah. Oh.
That's the sort of chap he was. He was, more cerebral than popping off to the pub, you know.
Yes. Oh, that's very interesting. So he obviously has an interest in trade unionism.
Yes.
Gets involved in the trade union movement. But how does that evolve? Because, this is 19th century New South Wales, in the colony of New South Wales in Sydney. Mm-hmm. There wasn't the Labor Party there that we know today. It was very much in its infancy, wasn't it?
Very, very much in its infancy. And he happened to just arrive at the vital moment when it was all falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
And in the various colonies, the perception was growing among working class people, and obviously at that time overwhelmingly men, that it made a lot of sense for Labor to get its own representatives into Parliament.
Right.
This was more spectacularly the case in Queensland, where they had the big shearer strike of 1891, and that was brutally repressed with government involvement, and that was stark evidence for those Labor people who thought that way, that they had to get their own people into the Parliament and the judiciary so that there'd be more fair treatment. And so,
and I should just jump in here, Ross. Not only are you an author of a biography on Chris Watson, but you're an author of a history of the Labor Party, The Light on the Hill, the Australian Labor Party 1891, obviously, Shearer's strike, to 1991.
Yep. Thank you, Georgina. And this Watson book really stemmed from the history of the party.
Mm. So how big a shift for trade union members and the trade union movement was it from that sort of organised workplace activism to forming a political movement? Because,
big shift.
I mean, it seems obvious to us these days, but that wasn't the case in the 19th century.
No, it was not. And the remarkable thing is that, in terms of Watson individually, is that they're having these spirited meetings with large attendances trying to work out what's the best way to go. They're formulating new procedures for a new party, and he's chairing these sometimes volatile meetings at the age of 25.
Yes, he's not old, is he?
He's not old.
So at the age of only 22, I think this is right, he becomes a delegate to the New South Wales Trades and Labor Council.
Yes.
And then he's inaugural secretary of the newly formed Labor Electoral League branch at West Sydney in 1891. So he's a man in a hurry, isn't he?
He is. And
a young man in a hurry.
And the meetings I had in mind, particularly when he was only 25, he became, at 25, both chairman of the new Labor Party in New South Wales and president of the Trades and Labor Council, the TLC. So he's at the helm of...
So he's a union boss and the leader of the political party, the political wing.
At 25.
At 25.
At 25. It's extraordinary.
I mean, we have to bear in mind people's life expectancy back then was vastly less than it is today, but still that is quite the rapid rise, isn't it?
It's striking. It really is.
So he had a central role then in the formation of the New South Wales Labor Party, along with the other figures. And this, of course, was in an era of colonial politics. We're pre-Federation. But tell me about his role in the lead-up to Federation, because, again, I think this is a story that isn't widely known, about how the different political parties and movements in Australia took very, very different views on the draft constitution and on Federation. Yes. And actually, I think some of those positions live with us today.
Yes. Well, the Labor Party's always had been composed of people, members, activists with different perspectives on what's the appropriate pace of change that's desirable. And this was no more demonstrated than in the 1890s. And some were against the concept of Federation. Some thought it was probably a good idea, but the particular constitution that the constitutional conventions had shaped didn't appeal to them, and they thought, well, we can't go along with it in that form. And then they had different attitudes at a colonial level in the Labor Party. And so this was all very fluid. Watson had entered the New South Wales Parliament himself in 1894. So he was an MP there. The leader of the Labor Party in New South Wales was Jim McGowan. New South Wales had an election in 1891. This new party had been formed. There were 141 seats, and Labor burst onto the scene spectacularly by winning 35 and seizing the balance of power. That was quite a remarkable debut in 1891. So where I was going there was that the leader who emerged from there was a chap named Jim McGowan. So Watson was not the leader in 1894 and the later 90s when he came in, but McGowan stood for federal parliament, didn't win. So he's not there when the first Labor caucus in federal parliament, 1901, meets to choose a leader. By that time, Watson has a fine reputation in and beyond his own colony as a very capable operator and potential leader. New South Wales, as a colony, the Labor Party in New South Wales has advanced more than elsewhere. So he's got that going for him as well, Watson. And so it was no surprise when he was elected leader at the first federal caucus meeting in 1901.
And at this stage, how old is he?
He's 1901. He'd be
35. Wow.
Yep. First leader of the FPLP, Federal Parliamentary Labor Party, is Chris Watson, 1901.
And, Ross, who were the people who were voting for Labor? I mean, you said at the New South Wales election they won 35 seats, first time they had put themselves forward electorally as a political party, a great result. Who were their constituency who were voting for them?
Well, a lot of workers having a tough life.
Yeah.
That's the core of it.
In the cities or in the country?
Mainly the cities, but in the countryside as well. Watson himself had played a big role. Some of the electorates were multi-member. Watson ran the campaign for an inner city seat where there were four candidates to be elected. All four got up from the Labor Party, and he was organising that. And he then said in 1894, when he decided to stand himself, that the harder task for Labor would be to win seats in the country.
Mm.
So he said, I'll take that on myself.
Mm.
He won a rural seat of Young.
And in terms of structuring this new political party, this is very interesting because a lot of the structures still exist to this day, mm. don't they?
Yes.
Sort of parliamentary solidarity pledge and the sovereignty of the conference, Labor Party conference over the parliamentary party. These were things that were decided in the 1890s.
Correct. And he's a very prominent figure and running some of the volatile meetings that ended up with those decisions.
And this really central role of the Labor Party executive too, that was not a parliamentary body at all. It was a body of office bearers.
Yes. So there's a strong view that with this new party, its representatives had to be kept under a close leash, under a tight rein,
yes.
and to make sure that they did none of this going off to posh surroundings and losing touch with their roots and the people that had elected them. So there were new structures. And as I said, there were these incredibly volatile meetings trying to work through these issues, and Watson was very involved in those meetings, yeah.
What was the basis, though, for these, I guess, institutional strictures? I mean, it was very much against people being free thinkers, going off on a frolic of their own, that this was controlled by a body external to the caucus, to the parliamentary party. Was it because they, because it's quite different, say, from Robert Menzies' Liberal Party that he forms in the 1940s, where it was very much encouraging people to be free thinkers, and if people did disagree with policy, they, I mean, it was obviously disappointing, but it was certainly not, the consequence of that wasn't that you were going to be kicked out of caucus or kicked out of the party, and the parliamentary party itself was determining policy, not the conference.
Mm-hmm.
So they're quite two different evolutions.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Is it because something was going on in trade union politics in the 1890s that meant that they needed to be more constrained?
Yes, it was a fluid process that took years, and some of those 35 that were initially elected in 1891, for example.
Mm, in New South Wales.
In New South Wales, yeah. Yeah, they fell out. It was an early split, and, and one of them's Joe Cook.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, and he later became an anti-Labor Prime Minister, of course. So there were debates about how appropriate it was for these attempted controls to be implemented, and not everyone agreed that it was appropriate, and those that didn't agree it was appropriate tended to find themselves outside the Labor Party.
Indeed, indeed. Well, as and we'll get on to this later, as Chris Watson found himself in due course.
Yes.
Ross, Chris Watson is elected leader of the new Federal Labor Party in the new Parliament of the Commonwealth of Australia, having at least been elected as opposed to McGowan, who had not succeeded in being elected to his seat and was presumed heir apparent to that leadership role. What did he do in those first couple of years of the Federal Parliament? He was obviously not in government. Edmund Barton's our first Prime Minister, and of course then Alfred Deakin. Mm-hmm. What were the policy positions and the, I guess, the positions they took in terms of supporting or not supporting the governments of the day in this really fascinating early time of Federation?
It is fascinating, Georgina, and what underpins it? And there's this absolutely critical, fundamental circumstance that whenever one goes into analysing this sort of stuff, you cannot lose sight of, and that is that for the entire first decade of federal parliament, no party had a majority in either house.
Yes.
No party had a majority in either chamber of the federal parliament for the first decade of federal politics.
Well, of course, we take for granted the preeminence of the two-party system of it's either Liberal or Labor, or at least Coalition or Labor, whereas back then it was the protectionists, the free traders and the Labor Party.
Yes.
And I love the term that was coined for the three of them.
The 311s. Yes, that was Alfred Deakin's phrase to illustrate how, from his point of view, having become Prime Minister, how intractable he felt that the parliamentary numbers were. And the way he talked about it, some thought betrayed his lack of sophisticated knowledge of cricket, but that was another matter. The phrase certainly took hold.
Yes, yeah.
And people understood what he was trying to get at. Yeah. Mm. Now, in terms of Watson, Labor had this approach that they adopted in this early phase where there were three parties whenever they could, and that was what they called support in return for concessions.
Yeah.
And this was to say, okay, well, we've got three parties here. Labor's view is we're not interested in becoming a government ourselves. Yeah. What we're interested in, we've got this platform, we've got these policies, we'll support whoever is going to implement them.
Why did they not see themselves as a party of government, though? That's quite a big policy call for the party.
They had limited numbers, and they thought this was the right way to go before it became different circumstances that led to a different policy position and nudging closer to a two-party system.
Mm.
While we had the 311s going, it was an understandable approach to say, well, we're not interested particularly in becoming government ourselves. What we're interested in, we've got these policies, everyone knows what they are, and we'll say to these other groups in Parliament, we'll support either of you to become the government. We don't mind which it is, as long as you deliver our policies for us. And it's perfectly democratic. It's open. And in the first phase of federal Parliament, they supported the protectionists, who were overall a more radical outfit and more congenial to the Labor Party.
And Watson himself was a protectionist, wasn't he?
Watson, yep.
Yes.
And he was much closer to Alfred Deakin,
yes,
in personal terms than he was to the alternative in Reid, the leader of the Free Traders. So it was that side of it too, and Deakin liked Watson. They were good friends. So it made sense for Labor to support, on a support in return for concessions basis, the protectionists, which they did, until Deakin felt that the situation had become impossible and he took action to enable the Labor government to govern in 1904.
Yes, it was over a amendment to the Conciliation and Arbitration Bill, wasn't it, which is a real focus of Labor's policy position, wasn't it?
Yes.
Naturally. On the workplace.
So, yes, so that was a key objective for Labor, to get a bill up that was congenial to them, that had appropriate provisions in it. And it was a controversial piece of legislation that was often debated in Parliament. But in the end, Deakin said, well, I think he seemed to feel that it's about time that Labor got a taste of governing.
Is that right?
He seemed he was a bit fatalistic about bringing this particular provision of the Conciliation Arbitration Bill in, sensed it wouldn't get up, and when it didn't, he said, okay, well, so be it. I'm resigning, I'm out of here, and recommended to the Governor-General that Watson be approached.
Not Reid.
Not Reid.
Yes.
Reid was expecting to be approached.
Mm.
Deakin recommended the Governor-General ask Watson. The Governor-General took that advice, invited Watson to form a ministry, and that's why you're asking me to do the podcast, Georgina.
Well, indeed. Otherwise, yes, you perhaps wouldn't have written this book. Tell me, though, just before we go on to the Watson government, which is not a long-lived government, but still there's lots to talk about, this support for concessions, so we're not going to be a party of government, we're going to extract concessions from whoever is in government, be it the free traders or protectionists, to implement policies that, you know, will agree with their policy if they, for example, prioritise, you know, a union workplace. Or there were, obviously, given Labor Party's roots, they were very focused on the preeminence of union power in workplaces across Australia. So this idea of support for concessions, despite the small 311s, there are not many members in Parliament, do you think they were able to have an outsized influence then on the government's policy direction, because they were saying, we'll support you, we won't oppose your legislation if you do it our way?
I think the approach is best described as, we'll support you as long as you bring in our measures.
Mm.
Doesn't mean that Labor's going to refrain from voting against other things that the protectionists want to bring in if Labor doesn't agree with them. I mean, that's what happened with the Conciliation Arbitration Bill provision. Yeah. Yep. Another response is to say that some critics of the way government was unfolding or being administered in this early phase of 311s were inclined to describe it belittlingly as the government is effectively, as boils down to, a slogan of, yes, Mr. Watson.
Ah, yes, of course.
Yes, Mr. Watson. Now, they were saying, from a very hostile perspective, what a joke that is, how ridiculous that is. So people who propagated that viewpoint clearly were not impressed by the support in return for concessions model.
No, and those people certainly would have been the people at the Maitland Daily Mercury.
They would.
For example.
They would indeed.
So in 1904, Chris Watson is appointed yes. Prime Minister of Australia, not elected, and that's the important point, actually. Yes. He doesn't ever win election as Prime Minister. He has to form a ministry, and this presents pretty major problems for him. How does he go about forming his first and actually only ministry?
The caucus had some debates about how to proceed, and one of the first things they had to grapple with was what was appropriate about the creation of the ministry. And one thing they wanted to, it would help the new government get parliamentary support if they had some protectionists in it, actually in the ministry. They approached Kingston, the former Premier of South Australia. He was not unwilling, but very ill.
Right.
So the doctor ruled him out. So then they went and approached Higgins, and Higgins was a Deaconite protectionist. He was a barrister and a future High Court judge, and Labor felt that they had to have someone with legal expertise to become Attorney General. Unlike today, there were hardly any lawyers in federal caucus in the Labor Party. The only one
who hard to imagine, really.
It is. It is head-shaking stuff. But the only one who was Billy Hughes. He had just recently graduated as a lawyer, and he's the most unlikely shrinking violet you can imagine. But he decided that being in that role presumed a level of legal expertise that he felt he didn't possess, or he knew he didn't possess, having only just graduated. So
it's an unusual amount of modesty.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, that's what he concluded at the time. So, and Hughes had a significant role here because he was helping Watson choose the ministers. Just going back a bit, caucus had the debate. They endorsed approaches to supportive, radically inclined protectionists, i.e. to Higgins and before him to Kingston. They also, in the end, decided that Watson should have a free hand. So this was not what later became the convention of a caucus electing the ministry, but Watson should have a free hand in deciding. Now, the way Watson implemented that was to say, okay, well, I'll go ahead and do that. And he arranged with the Governor-General that he had a few days, I think it was about a week, to choose the ministry. But he invited two certainties to help him select it. And Billy Hughes is one of those. So the other was a chap named Batchelor from South Australia. And those two chose the others. And the others were Andrew Fisher, who later became Prime Minister, Andy Dawson, who had been the Premier of Queensland in the 1 week first Labor government in the world in 1899, and he had a bit of cred and seniority for that reason. There was also Labor's Senate leader, remarkable chap, Gregor McGregor, who was practically blind but revered in the party, and he overcame his disability with this remarkable memory.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So he was included. He's former, he's a rough and tough sort of former labourer and ex-wrestler, practically blind. Remarkable inclusion. And they also had in mind interstate balance. And so they, with McGregor and Batchelor from South Australia, they had Dawson and Fisher from Queensland, they had Hughes and Watson himself from New South Wales. They had Higgins, the lawyer from Victoria, and they just felt that they couldn't carry two states unrepresented. One maybe, but not two. So they had to have someone from Tassie or WA, and they chose Hugh Mann and made him Postmaster General. He's a chap from West Australia who had an interesting background because he was an ardent Irish nationalist who had been jailed with Parnell back in 1881. So the Maitland Daily Mercury
yes.
and like-minded critics felt that this was an absolutely ludicrous idea, that you could possibly have this unthinking monstrosity of a government where you've got a compositor running a nation. The compositor is the Prime Minister, Watson, running the nation, and he's got two ex-miners. He's got a blind ex-wrestler, and he's got, horror of horrors, an Irish fanatic.
Yes, yeah.
In the ministry. Critics are up in arms.
Yeah, they say, I mean, we should go on with this quote, it's so funny. To call this preposterous production a government is ridiculous and would be laughable were it not for the painful pitilessness of having so monstrous a travesty administering the affairs of a great country which needs the best services of its most patriotic, independent and capable sons. Anyway, yeah, so this wasn't exactly the sort of ministerial experience that at least the papers were calling for.
It wasn't conventional.
No.
That's the thing.
Yes, unconventional experience for these ministers.
This is unthinkable.
So how radical was this first Labor government of Chris Watson's?
Well, we can't underline enough how radical it was as a concept, yeah, to have miners and labourers,
Tradesmen, wrestlers,
yeah, running a government, running a ministry. I mean, this was absolutely unthinkable. And so it's very radical in that sense, yeah?
Mm.
But you perhaps mean radical in terms of what they did, what
Indeed.
They proceeded
yes.
to do.
Yes, what did they stand for and was it radical? I mean, what were they pushing for?
Well, they were very vulnerable. I mean, because it wasn't just a few cranky newspapers who carried on like the Maitland Daily Mercury. This was a widely held view. Mainstream papers felt similarly, and the MPs, non-Labor MPs, a lot of them, most of them, felt similarly. And they were up in arms too. And Reid, the leader of the Free Traders, who had expected to be anointed by the Governor-General, was very taken aback that he wasn't. He initiated overtures to like-minded protectionists that we should form an alliance to get rid of this ridiculous monstrosity of a government. And these conversations were being had and the papers were going ballistic. And in actual fact, both the papers, or some of them, both some of the papers and some of the MPs were calling for and acting to bring into effect the removal of the government before the ministers had even been sworn in.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, so they are vulnerable. They're a minority government and it was blindingly obvious that any sort of radicalism, ambitiousness in office to do things quickly was not possible or sensible or feasible. So the understandable approach was to focus on showing that far from the Maitland Daily Mercury's view of the world, Labor with a government of workers could govern effectively. It could govern effectively, and that's what they proceeded to do. And this emphasis, moreover, suited Watson's instinctive moderation, moderate approach. And so that was where he wanted to go anyway, but the reality was that they couldn't do anything else. And so they managed to stave off the initial vulnerability and those manoeuvres to get rid of them very quickly. And it was tough trying to get legislation through. As we've said, they had conspicuous minority in the House and in the Senate and a substantial number of implacable opponents. So it was tough to get things through in the Parliament, but they persevered, did what they could. The government remained for 4 months, and in that time they achieved their main objective, definitely achieved their main objective. They showed that it wasn't impossible or peculiar or unthinkable for workers to run a government.
Mm.
And they did it well, and by the end of the 4 months, they had achieved that objective such that Labor, after the fusion of the Free Traders and the Protectionists, and so the two-party system as we know it was basically created, in the aftermath of that, Labor, then under Andrew Fisher, because Watson had by then resigned, won this remarkable victory in 1910, where after 10 years of federal parliament, without any party having a majority in either chamber. In 1910, Labor had this spectacular success where Fisher-led Labor won power convincingly by having a majority in both houses at the 1910 election. And the fact that the electorate endorsed Labor in that way in 1910 was very much a product of the successful administration that Watson and his ministers had displayed in the 4 months of 1904.
It's interesting, I mean, because he only had 4 months as Prime Minister in government, you obviously can't expect too much of a legislative agenda to have got through, but it is interesting that...
And in minority, and in, minority,
yes, and in minority circumstances indeed. But the initial federal Labor platform, given all the difficulties getting all the state Labor parties to agree on it, I understand was just confined to 4 points of agreement, which was electoral reform, incorporating one adult, one vote, the total exclusion of coloured and other undesirable races... doesn't age well at all, old age pensions, and two specific proposals for constitutional reform. And then eventually they did get some more policies around a citizen army and compulsory arbitration.
Yes, what was created there stemmed from a conference, an intercolonial conference before the inception of federal parliament. And as you've said, Georgina, they sensibly highlighted policies that they could all agree on. And those were the ones that they chose. And, yeah, I mean, we understandably feel that white Australia is abhorrent in today's terms, but it should be pointed out that this was not just a matter of race, far from it. I mean, this is overwhelmingly also about protecting hard-won working wages and other working conditions that the activists felt would be vulnerable if white Australia was not adhered to. So that's part of it too that we shouldn't lose sight of.
Yes, I mean, we look at these things obviously through the lens of 2024 eyes, and you do need to understand the position of people in, well, in this case, 1904 was quite different. Ross, Chris Watson leaves politics pretty soon after this, and in fact, he gets kicked out of the Labor Party in the years to come and joins the Nationalists with Hughes, or at least forms the Nationalists with Hughes. Is that why we don't hear so much about him? Because he's not considered a Labor hero, do you think? He kind of sort of, you know, moves away from the party and then back into it?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that has contributed to him slipping from sight a bit. Possibly it did, but it's his personality. He's not an out there sort of a character. And Billy Hughes is remembered because he's a volatile customer and quotes emerge around him, such as at one time or another he was a member of every party except the Country Party, and someone said, well, how can that be? And he just said, oh, well, you've got to draw the line somewhere. Hughes sort of led himself to those sorts of anecdotes.
Right.
Watson's the opposite. Watson's a more measured character. So I think that's part of it. But as to him leaving the party, again, the contrast with Hughes is apparent. Watson's personality and style of leadership as Prime Minister were instrumental in his government's success. In this era of minority governments and intractable parliamentary unwieldiness, Watson's amiable personality, his unflagging affability and his capacity to get on harmoniously with practically everyone were vital attributes, vital characteristics. And he was 40 when he resigned as leader, unusually young. He found being PM in the difficult circumstances of minority government such a strain that he didn't want to do it again.
Right, that's very interesting.
Even when there was a later phase when Labor had more MPs than the Deaconite protectionists, and he still, there were people in caucus saying, well, we should be this. No, let Deacon be PM and we'll influence the policies that are enacted. Yeah. Anyway, that suited him. Didn't suit everyone in caucus, and the resistance to that contributed to his resignation, in fact. So he preferred to position Labor as a party of broad support to Deakin and the protectionists, even if Labor had more MPs than the protectionists had. He resigned as leader in 1905, but was talked out of it, and then resigned definitely in 1907, aged only 40. Now, it wasn't only the relentless demands of party leadership that had taken their toll. Barry Jones told me that he had heard, someone told him long ago, who knew Watson personally, and Watson, in fact, suffered so badly from piles that he worked at an elevated desk to avoid sitting down.
Wow.
His wife, Ada, was unhappy about him spending so much of his time away from her in Melbourne. So Ada's in Sydney, the national capital at that point before Canberra was Melbourne. And after Watson quit the leadership, he received many requests from admirers to reconsider. And with the same purpose in mind, a Labor women's delegation approached Ada, but they encountered a disarming response when she said, "I only want what you women all want, my husband at home with me."
Aww.
It was claimed after my book on the Watson government was published that Ada's loneliness when her husband had been away in Melbourne so much had contributed her developing a significant problem with alcoholism, and this had been a factor in Watson's resignation as leader. Now, I haven't seen this claim corroborated, but it may be correct. Who knows? And if she did have problems of that kind, it's certainly feasible that this could have influenced Watson's resignation. He remained as a valued senior advisor to his successor as Labor leader, Andrew Fisher.
Yes.
He resigned from federal parliament in 1910, but remained a valued senior advisor, even though out of parliament by then. And when World War I erupted and Hughes wanted to bring in conscription as part of the disastrous wartime split that eventuated, weighing it up, Watson felt on balance he thought conscription was the right way to go, and in fact played a crucial role behind the scenes when Labor had the parliamentary split and Billy Hughes led a batch of conscription-favouring renegades out of the Labor Party. Watson played a crucial role behind the scenes in the formation of the new Nationalist Party.
Mm.
He's an organiser behind there.
Which, of course, Robert Menzies ends up joining, enters politics.
Yep. So Watson was accordingly expelled from the Labor Party, as you said, but I referred in starting my answer to the difference between Hughes and Watson, and on this issue as well. And whereas Hughes was belligerently traducing anti-conscriptionists, sledging them in almighty terms, and they replied in the same vein, with Watson, it was more a case of him saying regretfully, this is mild-mannered Watson characteristic, "Well, my view is that conscription is appropriate, and if the major Labor view is the opposite and you want to expel me, well, it's a shame, but I understand it."
Wow, yes.
That sort of response, totally different from Hughes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ross, final thoughts, and you have touched upon this, but what can we say is the overarching legacy of the four-month Watson Labor government, the first national Labor government in the world?
Watson and his ministers proved that workers could govern.
Yeah.
Crucial for the entire ensuing history of the ALP, showing that workers could run a government capably. That's his key achievement and contribution.
Well, thank you so much, Ross, for bringing to light all that fascinating story of Chris Watson, a story that definitely deserves to be told again. It is pretty forgotten, and I think that's to our detriment. So thank you for righting that wrong. Great to have you on Afternoon Light.
Thanks, Georgina. Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's episode of Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute. Please make sure to subscribe and catch up on our latest online content on our website or on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook.